This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, according to the CDC, and almost 50% of adults in the U.S. are suffering from some form of it. With such staggering statistics, finding new strategies to prevent and manage heart disease is a big need. One local doctor is contributing to this research through singing. Singing as a kind of therapy to improve heart health hasn't been widely studied, but Dr. Jacqueline Kalinske at the Medical College of Wisconsin has been investigating this connection since 2017 with a focus on older adults. Her new study, funded by the National Institutes of Health, was just released this month, and Dr. Kalinske joins me now to share more about her research and findings. Dr. Kalinske, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks, Audrey.
So we know personally that if we enjoy singing, no matter our skill level, that usually we feel good after. But what caught your interest as a cardiologist about studying singing and how it impacts our physical health?
Well, you know, when I observe people singing, and this is usually professional singers, you can often get a sense for how hard they're working from an exertional standpoint, right? Even after a 5-minute performance on stage, singers look out of breath. And that got me thinking a little bit about, you know, singing as a form of exercise. You know, do we know if singing is a form of exercise? More specifically, do we know what impact singing has on heart health? One thing I study in my lab in a variety of different studies is vascular function. So it's the function of our blood vessels. More specifically, there is this really important single layer lining of cells on the inside of blood vessels called endothelial cells, and they're incredibly important for heart health. And the neat thing about those endothelial cells is that we can measure the function of them non-invasively. And of course, you know, trying to make the corollary to exercise, we know that a short bout of exercise improves the endothelial cell function, you know, even 10 or 15 minutes of exercise. And so I wanted to test that hypothesis using singing as an intervention and then measuring endothelial cell function before and after singing.
You mentioned this improves our endothelial function, exercise of some level, and correlating that with singing. And with singing as a form of exercise, can you explain kind of why you were interested in looking at this and what you feel are some of the shortcomings of traditional rehabilitation programs for people with cardiovascular issues that you're trying to address with this study?
Absolutely. So the vascular function is a huge predictor of cardiovascular health, including future events. So we can kind of estimate one's risk of having a cardiovascular event by measuring their vascular function. In addition to that, we know that patients with coronary artery disease, the most common form of heart disease, all of those patients typically have some level of endothelial cell dysfunction, because that's where the plaque builds up, is between that layer of cells and the center, the media layer of cells. In the highest risk population, are older patients who have already had an event, so have already had a stent or a bypass surgery or a heart attack. And the traditional methods of lowering their risk, including traditional cardiac rehabilitation programs, include a component of physical exercise, right? It's where they get on a treadmill and they walk, sometimes go a little faster, and they're supervised by an exercise physiologist. The problem is several fold. Number one, older adults are less likely to participate in cardiac rehabilitation programs, even when their doctors refer them. And that's for a variety of reasons, but a lot of it has to do with they have other comorbidities or physical limitations, you know, arthritis, neuropathy, that make them worried that they won't be able to do the exercise component. So along those lines, this was the population that I think, you know, could serve to benefit the most from a different intervention, such as singing, you know, that can be considered an exercise, and they can do it while they're seated. And so at least it's something compared to nothing, right? I'd rather have them do something than nothing, especially if there's benefit, if we can prove that there is benefit in terms of cardiovascular risk and lowering their chance of having another event.
So you explained earlier that, you know, professional singers, you can tell it's exercise when they're up there performing. So can you explain the mechanisms of singing in relation to cardiovascular health and who you collaborated with to better understand this?
Yes. So singing, you know, involves a lot of diaphragm activation, right? And, you know, then there is some controversy about the type of muscle that a diaphragm is, but, you know, it is smooth muscle, but it kind of behaves as a skeletal muscle because we do have some control over it. That's kind of the deciding factor. So that is the one muscle that gets activated with singing. And of course, you know, when you have take deep breaths and expand the lungs, you're not only working the lungs, but you're activating the vagus nerve. So it's one of the longest nerves in the body. You know, it goes all the way from the midbrain down to the gut. And when you hear about brain, heart, gut axis, they're talking about the vagus nerve. So it's a very specific nerve, and it actually innervates our vocal cords, our larynx, parts of the throat, and then it connects to the diaphragm too. So when we do take deep breaths, you know, our heart rate can actually change, and that's due to vagal nerve stimulation. And so there, you can see that there are different mechanisms of the likely benefits of singing and exercise as well on cardiovascular health. And then, of course, the thing that I study too is the vasculature, the endothelial cells. We didn't know, I would say before I got into this research, we didn't know what singing does to the endothelial cells or the function of them. And so this is like a very innovative research question, and it's got a lot of attention, you know, for good reason. But sure enough, we found that in our very first study that just 14 minutes of singing led to improvements in the vascular endothelial function. So lots of different mechanisms. Now, to your point, Audrey, I'm not a musical expert and I don't claim to be. And so I've worked with numerous musical experts during this research. So two voice professors from UW-Milwaukee and UW-Madison, and then a team of music therapists, one in particular that's been with me for several years doing this research. And so they provide their expertise, and they designed and made the interventions, you know, that we ended up using in the clinical trials. I can't do this research without that expertise. So it has been fun and rewarding to work with such a diverse group of experts.
So with their input, that influence what the study became. So can you explain to me what your participants went through?
Yes. So, you know, I'll talk about the big trial that we just wrapped up. It was a 5-year trial funded by the National Institutes of Health. We wanted to include, number one, a control. And then we had two different singing interventions. So we had the singing intervention that we used several years ago that was successful, which was a instructional sing-along video. And so the professor of voice recorded the video. They were in the, you know, background. So it was Wendy Rowe. She was in the background on her piano. And then she would have a patient kind of closer to the camera in the video as well. And they would sing together. She would instruct him and she would be playing the piano. And so it was consisted of 10 minutes of vocal warm-up, and then 10 minutes going through one song at various rhythms and tempos, and then 10 minutes of another song. And the subjects could pick the songs based on their preferences. So that was all pre-recorded, and they would just watch it, you know, independently and sing to it, you know, as they saw fit. And then the second intervention we did in person because, you know, my thought was, well, you know, like cardiac rehabilitation programs, you know, the patient is exercising with an exercise physiologist there to help them and like coach them and guide them. And so the thought was we should have somebody in person doing that for the subjects too, and maybe it'll be even more beneficial. And so that was an in-person session with a board-certified music therapist. Now, because it's a clinical trial, we have to do our best to keep things similar. So the format was, again, similar. So 30 minutes total, 10 minutes warm-up, and then two songs of their choosing to make up the full 30 minutes. And then we had a control visit. The control visit ended up being a hearing test. So it was 30 minutes of really not doing a whole lot other than getting a hearing test done. And we performed the same measurements before and after each 30-minute session. And they had to have at least 2 days between each visit. So it was a crossover trial, which means that every subject gets all three visits. We ended up enrolling 65 subjects. They were all older patients with known coronary artery disease, as I said, so a high-risk population that honestly serves to benefit maybe the most from this type of intervention. But what we found is that, yes, even compared to the control arm, the singing for 30 minutes led to improvements in vascular endothelial function. There was one finding that somewhat surprised me. So it was the video intervention is the one that worked, or the one that showed the improvement. So similar to our pilot study that we did before, the visit with the coach turned out non-significant. And I don't think it's because it didn't work or it wasn't beneficial. I think it had to do with, unfortunately, some interruptions during the COVID pandemic. The other thought, after speaking to other experts in this area of research, is that, you know, perhaps there was some anxiety. If you're not like a seasoned singer like myself, like maybe it makes you a little nervous to do that. And so if nerves were playing a role, that could certainly impact endothelial function too, like anxiety or stress. But either way, you know, we just got the paper published and we're getting the results out there and already, you know, hearing from other experts in the field, organizing conferences that we can hear about each other's research. So it's just a really exciting area right now.
So given that, I mean, research is a long game, as you well know, and mm-hmm. there's more stages to this and more work to do. So what are some of your long-term goals for this study with these preliminary results that you're seeing?
Yes. Thanks, Audrey. It's a great question. So eventually, I would like to see this incorporated into cardiac rehabilitation programs. That is my ultimate goal. But what that's going to look like remains to be determined. So kind of the next step, the next grant that I'm working on and hoping to get funded is looking at group singing. And the reason for group singing is because now you're getting together, you know, members of the similar population, so the aging population with heart disease, and there is a degree of loneliness in some of these older populations. And, you know, if we can get them all together, not only could they get the potential cardiovascular benefits, but they could get all these other social well-being, psychological benefits, and just having that social connectedness. And not only that, but, you know, when you think about long-term, how to implement this in real life settings or real world settings, we always have to think about payers and insurance and like, are they going to cover this? You know, is this something they would cover? And I would say they're probably more likely to cover something like this if the costs are lower, right? So we are going to be testing group singing interventions in a similar population. That's the next step.
Excellent. Well, it's really exciting and interesting work. And Dr. Klinsky, I want to thank you so much for joining me to explain more about it.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Audrey.
Dr. Jacqueline Kalinsky is a general cardiologist and an associate professor of medicine and cardiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can find more information and a link to the newly published study at wuwm.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn about the best ways to avoid tick bites and Lyme disease. But first, we'll learn about a newly recreated tavern at Old World, Wisconsin, and what you'll learn about the state's brewing history on a visit there. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's time now for our Tavern Tuesdays series. We're partnering with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin to bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. Last week was the grand opening of the restored Wittenables Tavern at Old World, Wisconsin. Today, we'll hear from Rob Novak. He's the Brewing Experience Coordinator and Beer and Brewing Historian at Old World, Wisconsin. Novak met with WUWM's Eddie Morales at Wittenables to talk about how Old World Wisconsin recreated a post-Prohibition era tavern.
So this building was built sometime around 1906, and it was actually attached to a farmhouse, which would have been on the back side of the building. So it was really a secondary business for the Wittenable family at the time. they were farming during the day, and then, or whoever was home during the day would be in the house, and there was actually a bell that could be rung when a guest came in, and they'd come out and serve them a beer. It was primarily a beer and liquor establishment. Back then, in a rural tavern, you didn't really have cocktails necessarily. Maybe you had wine, but you had beer, you had brandy, you had, well, beer and whiskey, and then later brandy. So this originally was kind of a meant to serve the community of Old Ashapan, which back then was just Ashapan, and the family and extended family and friends of the Whitnables and other people in town would have been the customers. So they knew each other. I think it would have been very rare, pre-Prohibition especially, very rare to have a stranger walk through the doors. And there were at least two taverns in town. So there weren't that many, but it was a small town. So you had your two options. We don't have a ton of information from pre-Prohibition Whitnables, but looking at other histories of taverns, rural taverns, it's not hard to imagine what the space would have been like. And pre-Prohibition, you still had a very male-dominated drinking clientele. It wasn't until after Prohibition that you started to see a little bit more opening up for women and families. Although Whitnables was run by a husband and wife team, so it's quite possible that there were more women drinking in here than your average establishment.
And what are some of the things on the walls, and what's the thought process behind trying to recreate this environment?
When you walk in, we want you to feel like you're walking into the 1930s, but also in a very immersive way that almost makes you feel like you're on a movie set. You know, like, oh, wow, this space is everywhere you look, there's something that gives you a hint as to what year you're in. Whereas out on site, I do feel like the older farms, it's hard for me to tell the difference between like 1880 and 1890. And my coworkers will probably tease me about that. But in here, the difference between 1930 and 1900 is obvious. The technology, the souvenirs, the things that are on the wall. We chose places in Wisconsin that opened in the 30s or 40s for some of our souvenirs and items that would have been produced at the time as well. We chose 1934 as our entry point because that was the repeal of Prohibition, the reopening of drinking establishments. So everything in here, it's a 10-year range, 34 to about 44. Most of the things are mid to late 30s or reproductions of things from that era because we want guests to interact with things in here. So we have a lot of reproductions. We have originals in our collection of things, but we can't have those being interacted with. So reproductions of community gathering posters and flyers. So there's the Ashapan Fireman's Park picnic, which included, let me see if I can find it on there, something I didn't know about was a water fight where these firefighting crews would actually spray each other with their fire hoses in like sort of a battle. And so we thought that was really cool. It's a fundraiser, right? A local community fundraiser. What this era represents is a chance for our guests. They come out of the farms on site, which go as late as 1910. And then they jump into the 1930s, which gives them a sense of, oh, maybe my grandparents came to a place like this or my great-grandparents, whereas the rest of the site, that's like three or four generations past. So it's a little harder to connect to now. But we can show them things that we take for granted, like the phone on the wall, the historic phone. I think like my generation knows what that is because we used phones growing up. But my son might not know what that is. So he gets to learn how people communicated. And we can make that phone ring. Call out, have a guest answer for us. And listen to whatever's happening in town. So there's three different calls right now dealing with different topics. And so that's a neat thing for people to deal with. We had a fun time getting the actors to record those with proper Wisconsin accents. The pictures, some of them are from the Whitnables. Next to the door, we have a picture of the Lithia sign in the early 40s. That's the only reason we knew that sign was there, is we noticed it in that photo. And Buriana collectors, they're very good at finding things. And we did find a gentleman who had the same version of that sign in his collection. So we got a lot of photos of it, and that's how we were able to recreate the Lithia sign. I've only seen photos of this one. I've never seen this one anywhere else. So we're still hunting those things down. But that's a little Easter egg. We're like, oh, that's the sign that's outside, which allowed us to recreate it. And there's other little things hidden in here as well that if people are paying attention, they can connect it to like well, the Wizard of Oz, for instance, had a weird connection to Oconomowoc, so it was essentially premiered there. People might not know that. That was this era. So we take a little liberty with the time. We're not like saying everything in here is 1934. We want to teach people kind of about that whole era. We can certainly focus on one year, and then the end of Prohibition is a big topic for us as well.
With all these different elements, you have educational, entertainment, immersive. What's the hope for guests when they leave? What's the takeaway for them?
Whit Nables has dual purpose, really. First and foremost, we want to teach them what these rural taverns were like and what these communities were like. The cool thing about being a bartender in here is a lot of the bartenders from historic taverns from the 1870s to the 1930s became like local politicians, because they would hear everything from everybody and they would kind of be like the center of information. So people could come in, there'd be a news board on the wall, or the bartender would have the news. So-and-so would mention something, and then that would get kind of sent out through the grapevine at the bar. You know, we certainly weren't calling everyone. Not everyone had phones. We weren't sending letters to everybody. So the quickest way to find something out was probably go ask your local bartender. And that goes for rural, but also in the cities. Those bartenders became very powerful politicians, bartenders and brewery owners, because they controlled the flow of information as well as money. And as you know, you have a few drinks and people start talking. If they feel comfortable in your tavern, you become friends with them, essentially. And that has already started to happen in here, even without alcohol. This has become kind of an informal meeting spot for the staff. We come in and we have meetings in here, and it's just the space. There's something about the space that invites comfort. And Germans have this word Gemütlichkeit, that's hard to translate, but essentially that's what it means, is a place of comfort and a feeling of sort of warmth and ease.
Rob Novak is the Brewing Experience Coordinator and Beer and Brewing Historian at Old World Wisconsin. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Tavern Tuesdays is a partnership with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin. The restored Whit and Nables Tavern is now open. You can find other Tavern Tuesdays conversations at wuwm.com. Wisconsin is a hot spot for Lyme disease. Cases are rising as climate change and development alter how humans interact with the ticks that transmit this disease. The numbers reported each year have more than doubled in the last two decades. With tick season underway, tick checks are one of the most important ways that you can prevent infection. Lena Tran went to a lab at UW-Madison where researchers are using a new tool to teach people how to do tick checks, mannequins.
Their names are Vanessa and Valerie. Both are tall brunettes, both dressed in sportswear, and both covered in dead black-legged ticks, the species that carries Lyme. Tila Jemsch is a research specialist at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, where scientists study ways to control ticks and prevent infection. Jemsch says the lab found the mannequins on Facebook Marketplace. At first, Vanessa was supposed to stand in for a human in a study on how ticks attach themselves to people. But soon they realized she could be useful as an educational tool. Now they have a whole family of mannequins.
So we've got child mannequins, we've got teenagers, we've even got preteen mannequins. That way, the event that we take it to, it's set up for who's going to be looking at the mannequins.
Ticks are notoriously tough to spot. A few years ago, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shared this photo of a poppy seed muffin. There were five ticks camouflaged among the seeds. The idea was show people how small they can be, encourage them to stay vigilant. The internet was grossed out. Later, the CDC tweeted an apology, saying they didn't mean to tick people off. But here's the thing. You're not very likely to run into ticks on a muffin. So when you're teaching the public how to spot the tiny arachnids, wouldn't it be better to show them what ticks look like on a person?
What ticks gonna look like? So this is an idea of how to get it in a context people are going to see. They're not going to see it in an image. They're not going to see it under a microscope lens. They're probably going to run into a tick on themselves. And what does that look like?
I went to the lab to learn how the plastic people are helping the researchers' outreach efforts and test out my own tick spotting skills.
Pretend this is your friend. She's okay. Just gone hiking and she's asked you to check her for ticks. Okay. So see you. I'll let you know, point out to me if you think you found one, and I'll let you know if you found it.
Okay, she is like a brunette in all black performance clothing. Here's one.
Yep.
On her, like, waist. That one was easy, which makes it feel like a trick, because it's a lot bigger. Is that one?
That is one.
Oh, it's on her arm.
The two mannequins are nearly identical, except Vanessa is wearing all black. She also has classic bangs. Valerie keeps her hair in a side part, and she's dressed in white. Wearing light-colored clothing is an important part of tick prevention. Ticks are much harder to detect on dark clothes.
It's hard to tell whether it's, like, a stain or if it's just an actual tick, which is really tough.
Adult ticks are the biggest and easiest to see. It's the baby nymphs that you really need to hunt for. Ticks don't carry the bacteria that causes Lyme on their own. They have to draw blood from wildlife hosts like deer or mice first. The bacteria spreads when an infected tick bites another animal, like a human. When a tick bites you, they can hang on for days. As they feed, they'll swell, coming close to tripling in size. That's why it's important to do a tick check soon after you spend time outdoors. If you find and remove ticks right away, there's less time for bacteria to spread.
Poor Vanessa. She's in trouble. She, like, went off trail for sure.
Oh, yeah. She definitely went hiking and some brushwhacking. But, you know, she was out enjoying the day, and it's important that she's doing her tick check. So thank you for helping her.
Okay, here is a big one on her sock.
Yep.
And then is that one, or is it just, like, a piece of dirt? It's really hard to tell.
You tell me. What do you think?
Oh, I touched it. Maybe that's cheating. Okay, I think that's a piece of dirt.
Zemsh walks me over to Valerie, who's wearing the same outfit as Vanessa, but in white.
So this was another experiment that we did. We wanted to see, like, how black clothing and white clothing would affect them. Uh-huh. So she's got the exact same ticks that applied to her in the same spots. Uh-huh. So you did a really good job.
Zemsh says my performance on the test pretty much mirrors what they've learned from the demos at public events. People are better at finding ticks on white clothes than dark clothes. They're also better at spotting them on the upper body than the lower body. And people are much better at finding adult ticks than the young, tiny nymphs. Zemsh points to one that's the size of a sesame seed, which I missed on the black pair of tennis shoes, but they're easy to see on the white shoes.
So I recognize these pants from Target.
They are exactly from Target, yes. Good eye.
I think I have the same ones as her.
Honestly, it was really cute. I went to go buy the mannequin's outfits, and then I came back a week later to purchase those in my size. Beautiful.
Well, now I'm like, I should have gotten the white ones.
White ones, yeah. I mean, cute, but yeah, it does really make you think, right?
When you bring them out to events and things like that, what is kind of the average success rate that you're getting?
So, great question. The average success rate when we took these out for the surveys, we had 16 ticks that were attached to them, and the average found was 7.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The researchers are using these results to come up with recommendations for more successful tick checks.
So first off, before I ever start my hike, I'm going to make sure that I tuck my pants into my socks, my shirt into my pants, so I don't have as much of a access to the skin for the ticks. It gives me more chances to spot them. And then when I'm done with my hike, or done with my hike or time outdoors, I start at my feet and then I work my way up. So I will check every little crevice. If I'm wearing shoes that have, like, flaps or folds into them, I also want to make sure I peel that back and look at that. I then will kind of make my way up my legs, and I'll just keep checking seams. I'll keep checking anything that looks even a little bit like a tick. If I've got a friend with me, I'll ask them to check my back, because I'm unlike our mannequins here, it's not quite as easy for me to see my back. I will then take my clothes and I'll put them into the dryer. So if I missed anything, the ticks will hopefully desiccate into the dryer. Showering afterwards helps too. I like to use insect repellent, so that also works with repelling ticks. So I'll make sure I use something like DEET or Picaridin so that I can hopefully have less of them on me. And then the ones that I do find with that tucking in and like methodic check from down up can get anything else.
If you do find a tick on you, you can take a photo and send it to experts to identify.
So we actually have a app called the Tick App that you can send in photos for identification of what the tick is. And by how big the tick is, people can actually tell how long it's been feeding. And depending on how long ticks have been attached, different pathogens transmit over different amounts of time. So there is kind of like a rate that you can tell of how big the tick is, roughly how long it was on you, and then if you should be worried about potentially a tick-borne pathogen.
What should people do at that point if they find a tick on them?
If it hasn't attached to you, you want to make sure that you remove it from yourself. If it has attached to you, it's really, really important actually that what you do is you take tweezers or some kind of instrument that you can pluck the tick. But you want to make sure that you get down as close to your skin as possible. They've got this it's called a hypostome. It's like a little straw, essentially, that they put into your skin. You want to get as close to that as possible. Pinch that and then pull up, twist a little bit. What you really want to make sure that you don't do is grab the tick by its body, because if you do that, you'll essentially cause them to regurgitate what's in their stomach into you, and that could potentially have pathogens. So you don't want to have them, you know, vomit or throw up pathogens into you. So you want to get down to as close to that straw as possible and then pull up.
As climate change makes our winters warmer, Wisconsin is seeing longer tick seasons. The spread of Lyme disease is also influenced by wildlife populations and land use changes that are pushing people and development further into tick territory. All of this means it's becoming more and more important to make tick checks a routine part of being outside.
It's to spend time doing the tick checks, really doing it in a methodical way, spending your time on it and making sure that you're really checking everything. I mean, you know, the tick checks, it's... You know, I like them. I still do them every single time I go on a walk. But now, having done this study, there's just things that I'm also making sure that I do, like really making sure I'm tucking clothes in and spending time. You know, it's not just something to kind of check off the list when I'm done hiking. It's something really important. I want to make sure that I can stay healthy and keep enjoying the outdoors. So spending time on it, being really diligent about it.
Wow, now I need to go exchange my pants for the white ones.
They are cute, too.
Yeah, they are.
That was researcher Tila Jemsch, plus her lab assistants Vanessa and Valerie. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
That was Lena Tran reporting at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. We've got a new season of Bulbar Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. We'll take one more break, and then author Ira Madison III joins us to share his book of essays that weaves together pop culture, nostalgia, social commentary, and much more. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. Keep you safe, you wait and see. The only thing allowed to crawl all over you when we get there is me. You know every guy in here tonight would like to take you home, but I've got way more class than them, babe. That ain't what I want, 'cause I'd like to see you out in the moonlight. I'd like to kiss you way back. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and the host of the Crooked Media podcast, Keep It. Recently, he added author to his many titles with the release of his debut essay collection, Pure Innocent Fun. The book explores key cultural moments that inspired his career as a critic and impacted his life growing up as a Black gay man in Milwaukee. For Madison, TV shows, movies, and books were not just an escape, but turned out to be a tool for connection. He takes readers on a trip through the 90s and 2000s, diving into everything from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Oprah's talk show, and weekly trips to Mayfair Mall to see as many films as he could. Ira Madison III joins me to share more. And to start, here's an excerpt from Pure Innocent Fun.
February 2nd, 1999 marked the release of the most important historical text since the Bible. The Bible, of course, being the print edition of Entertainment Weekly, February 1990 to April 2022. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me, hanging out the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holla at me. TLC's No Scrubs was a seminal text for me, the version with Left Eye's rap only. Not only because it was a massive hit, but because my mom and sister routinely lobbed the lyrics at me over the fact that I never got my driver's license in high school. For most teenagers in Milwaukee, a car represents freedom. For instance, my younger sister got her driver's permit as soon as she could. But for me, who had a life that revolved around watching TV and walking to the comic book store and going to the movies at the mall, Mayfair Mall, there didn't seem to be much of a need to get my license. Besides, driver's ed seemed to happen immediately after school, and that coincided with rehearsals for the school plays. I worked on the stage crew for each show at Marquette University High School because I was finding myself falling in love with theater more and more. And if I couldn't be cast in a show, then I'd at least take a job that would let me take part in all the magic that I dreamed about when I would listen to the Rent original Broadway cast recording in my bedroom and try to make my high-pitched gay voice deep enough to match Adam Pascal's raspy voice on the song Another Day.
Ira Madison III, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, congratulations on your first book, Pure Innocent Fun. It's a collection of essays that shares stories and snippets of your life through the connective lens of pop culture, and specifically millennial pop culture. So first off, what was the inspiration for you to write these memories to share with us in this format?
Well, so my favorite book in high school was Chuck Klosterman's Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. And I think that was maybe the first thing, aside from like VH1's Best Week Ever, or, you know, like the I Love the 80s franchise, that introduced me to people talking about pop culture, talking about their memories of pop culture and how they influenced their lives, how they sort of made the decade make sense in a way. And I revisited that book often. I lent it to friends and I got it back. And I think around 2020, you know, when we were all at home for a very long time, I reread it for the first time, maybe in a few years. And it sort of hit me that I wanted to make my own version of that and a version that was sort of a tribute to that.
What's most central in your book is, of course, Milwaukee, right? And your formative years here. And I have to say that reading this gave me such a nostalgia hit and comfort, not just as a millennial, but also as a Milwaukee native like yourself. So the visualizations were particularly strong, and it felt like reminiscing. Yeah, it just felt like reminiscing about the early aughts with a friend and like all the stupid things we did in high school, or the things that were happening in pop culture, what we were obsessing over, you know. So can you share more about your upbringing here in Milwaukee and how it influenced not simply the essays you wrote, but of course your whole perspective?
Yeah, you know, my earliest memories that I write about are when I attended Highland Community School as a kid, and that led me to Morse Middle School. And I really enjoyed those schools a lot. Those were some of the more diverse schools in Milwaukee. And then after middle school, my culture shock was going to Marquette High School, which was an all-boys school. And at the time, you know, it was a largely all-white school too. So I think that that is something that definitely affected, you know, my upbringing and also sort of just thrust me into a world I wasn't really familiar with. And I think I retreated a lot into myself. I retreated a lot into books, into TV, into film. And the way that I was able to make friends with people was through discussing pop culture, discussing Seinfeld reruns, discussing Simpsons reruns, and spending nights watching movies with friends in their parents' basements. And that, I think, prepared me for college, where I was able to, you know, not connect with people as easily socially as other people immediately, but I could connect with people on music and pop culture. And I think that that really just sort of led me down the career path that I've had ever since.
Yeah, we grow up with these things and we latch on to like shows or movies, like maybe without knowing the significance at the time. And, you know, while I don't share the same experiences as you, such as going to Marquette High as one of a handful of Black students at a predominantly white school, I have to say I deeply empathize hard with the way you wrote about escaping into TV, movies, fanfic, you know, everything that gives you a safe space mentally. So do you think this is why pop culture and the nostalgia around it can be so powerful?
Yeah, I think that especially in a world, you know, where we have so much niche culture now, you know, there's not the monoculture of whatever was on TV last night. Chances are everyone watched it, you know, and if you didn't watch it, your parents watched it or your sibling watched it, you were at least familiar with it, you know. And now I think with there being so many disparate things to watch, you know, not everyone is watching Severance, you know, not people barely watch network TV. Maybe, you know, Real Housewives is sort of a monoculture, but, you know, I have friends who don't watch that as well, you know. And I think that these memories of things that we all love, that we all remember, sort of one, remind you of a place in time when you consume them. And then they also help you connect with your peers. There's this thing that people always say, and I mentioned it in the book, where you remember experiencing something in the past. And in a way, it feels like you were the only person who experienced that, like you and your friends. How many times have you seen a viral post online where someone starts with the prompt, name a TV show that you've watched that you're pretty sure no one else has ever seen, etc.? And sometimes people name shows that were pretty popular, like everyone's seen ER or Friends, yeah, and they've heard about it. But, you know, sometimes people will name much smaller shows that were canceled, you know, like a Pushing Daisies, shows that were canceled very quickly. And I think that when you go back and actually look at how many people watch those shows, we lived in a culture where, sure, the biggest shows on television got maybe 30 million viewers a week. And that show got maybe 10 million a week. And that's why it was canceled. But in this day and age, 10 million viewers a week would be a huge hit, you know? I think a lot of the things that felt niche and small to us at the time, millions of people actually have that same experience, you know? I think we just did not have the internet. We didn't have social media. We didn't have a way to know that the things that you were experiencing by yourself at home were lived experiences that many people had, not just in the US, but across the globe.
You know, in your books and your experiences, it's not just the power of pop culture, but especially the queer perspective of pop culture. And I think that also is a big factor in how millennials today are also viewing things, not just of their past, but today. Like before, it'd be all about little hints of subtext we could get, right? But, you know, it's more than that. It's camp. It's the random things we obsess over. And you have a podcast all about that too, right? So can you explain the importance of that lens?
Yeah. So my podcast, Keep It, which I've hosted for about 7 years now with my co-host, Louis Vertel, we dive into current pop culture each week, but we also always divert into nostalgic moments that we remember, sort of our tastes that have been developed by how we view things as young queer people in the 90s and early 2000s. And I think that it gives us also a different lens into pop culture right now, films that might seem on the surface a lot more queer, you know, that there's characters who are explicitly gay, you know, there people talk about their real queer lives, but I don't know, it feels a little bit like when you watch maybe films from the 50s or something, you know, or sort of like pre-code films where people had to talk in code and there was innuendo. And in a way, it feels like some of those pieces of culture are a lot more queer than many of the things that we experience now, just because people had to work with intent to really make those characters seem gay, really make those characters connect with an audience who would understand it. And now it just seems as if you can throw a character in something, say they're gay, and move on, you know?
I'm going to take a quick moment to reintroduce you. This is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, speaking with author and Milwaukee native Ira Madison III. So Ira, you've written for GQ, Vulture, The Cut, and MTV News, among others. But a story assignment obviously is very different to writing about your life through the lens of pop culture. So did you have any aspects of writing this book that felt strange or intimidating to you at first? Like, did it take a minute to find your voice when you're used to like, okay, this is my editorial voice on this one thing, but okay, we're getting personal now?
Yeah, you know, I have a very distinct writing style. You know, I said I called it ADD earlier, but I feel like comes across in my writing style too. I write the way that I speak. I write the way that I discuss topics on the podcast as well. We will, for instance, be talking about the Golden Globes and the wins, and then we will all of a sudden divert into, you know, we'll talk about a film that won, and we'll talk about the actor that was in that, and that will lead us into talking about other films of theirs and someone else who was in that movie. You know, I feel like it's my book is sort of like a road trip, and you're making a lot of different stops along the way, but you're eventually going to get to the destination. And when I write an assignment, which is much shorter, you know, something like 900 to 1200 words, it's edited down a lot, for one. And those diversions maybe only happen once. You know, you start with an intro topic and then you veer into the meat of your story. And then maybe you'll end with a kicker that's surprising or something, you know? And I think that I got so used to writing like that, you know, like it's you get an assignment, especially when you're writing about pop culture and it moves so fast, especially with the internet, you get an assignment in the morning and you need it done by the afternoon. This was sitting with topics that nothing was changing about them. You know, there wasn't new information. I didn't have to rush it out. And I was also reflecting more on my perspective and how much I wanted to share about my life. And, yeah, it felt like it went on forever, you know, trying to write, trying to get to that destination in each essay. And luckily, I found a healthy balance. I found a mode of doing that worked after the first couple of essays. But just starting the book was probably the hardest aspect of it for me.
Absolutely. In your book, you stated, especially in your teenage years, that you were on a diet of white pop culture media in a rejection of your mother. And, you know, I think a lot of families can identify with that. And also, if my family is good at one thing, it's not asking questions, especially Midwestern families. I'm sure it goes beyond the Midwest, right? But in writing this book, how have you felt sharing it with your family and the people closest to you?
Well, they have not read it yet. So
to be determined.
They will get their copies of the book in person when I do my stop in Milwaukee.
I know. It must be a scary thought, though, because you were living in your own world and your brain processing, living life as best you could while they have one perspective of it, too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But also, I would say that I'm less worried about some family members, particularly my grandmother, who I dedicate the book to. She is an avid fan of mine. She is the one who always encouraged me to write a book when I was younger. She's the one who would always take me to the bookstore after school. She was excited that I was finally writing a book after doing, you know, media and television for so long, just because she knew it was a dream I'd had when I was a kid. And she listens to the podcast sometimes too. And, you know, you sort of forget that that's happening. But sometimes she'll bring up something and I'm like, oh, you read that. And it's happened a couple other times where my mom or my sister has read something very personal and I forget that they're going to be reading it. So I'm pretty okay with my family reading those things. And, you know, I've sort of told them if there's something here you don't like, then You'll have to keep that to yourself.
It's already printed.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ira, so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed reading your book and kind of going down your memory lane and remembering stuff on my part as well. And so enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and host of the Crooked Media podcast, Keep It. His collection of essays is called Pure Innocent Fun. We spoke about it earlier this year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll examine white power movements taking place in the state. Plus, learn about the first professional women's basketball game played right here in Milwaukee. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.